All right, we are in Revelation chapter 6, the Lamb that was slain, who is the Creator God, has taken the scroll, for He is worthy. And it has seven seals on it, and these seven seals will be broken in succession. And it says in verse 1, "And when I saw, when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as it were the noise of thunder." Let me pause here just a moment. I grew up in the Midwest. I know some of you don't think Michigan's too far east to be the Midwest, but I grew up in Michigan. And I also lived for 9 years in South Carolina, and they have a phenomenon that we don't have very often over here. But they had something called thunderstorms. And that's actually one of... Did I unplug this? I did. And that's something we don't get a whole lot about here, but it's standard there in the summertime. You got a humid day, and you got 90% humidity. I remember in South Carolina it would be, 97 degrees, and you'd have 95% humidity. And you sweat, and it's got no place to go. But in the evening, it would cool down a little bit anyway. Might drop down to a downright comfortable 87 or something. But with that much of a drop in temperature, the air could not hold that much humidity. Lower the temperature, the less it can hold. And so we would get evening thunderstorms very frequently, sometimes several times a week. When I lived in South Carolina and Michigan, not quite as often, but quite frequently. And if you were looking to the east, which is not the direction they're coming from, you might see blue skies and the sun shining, and yet you listen and you can hear the rumble. And if you bothered to look over your shoulder, you could see the thunderheads rising in the west. And that thunder was a precursor of what was coming. And I believe that that's what we have here in verse 1. "And when the Lamb opened one of the seals, I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder." This is a precursor of what will follow, that the storm is coming. And we are dealing with the seventh week of Daniel in 927, Daniel 927. "And one of the four beasts... I heard one of the four beasts saying, 'Come and see.' And so I saw, and behold, a white horse." Pretty horse. White horse. Now let me pause here for a moment and discuss the nature of horses. And no, I'm not going to be talking about how much fun it is to ride, and how you get my rub down, and what kind of saddle to use, and all this other stuff. 2,000 years ago, and for quite a few centuries after and before, horses were not farm animals. If you had animals to work on a farm as far as pulling a plow or pulling a cart or something of that nature, you used oxen or you used donkeys. Horses were reserved as animals of war. I never seen anybody ride an ox into war. Donkeys have more sense than a horse in that when the going gets tough, they're going to get out of there. But a horse is going to do, for the most part, what it's told. It'll charge blindly into battle. The horse was an animal of war. And when you see a horse talked about in the scripture, almost invariably that is the connection with it. Now, a white horse, in our modern culture, and not quite so modern, when you're watching an old cowboy flick, the good guy, his horse is going to be white. And he's got a white hat on, too. This is in the stereotypical thing. And the bad guy's all dressed in black duds, and he's got about, 6 or 7 days of beard on his face, looks like he hasn't washed in about a month. He's all covered with dust and everything, but the good guy is always gleaming white. He looks like Mr. Clean with a white cowboy outfit on. In ancient times, a white horse was not real common. They were particularly valuable. And they were reserved for certain things. The Romans and the Persians, but primarily we focus mostly on the Romans because they're the ones that took a lot of Persian ideas and perfected them and built on them. They rode white horses in a triumph. Now, I don't mean a little British sports car. Very hard to get a horse into a triumph, as it is. No, it's when you had a Roman victory, the horse, I'll get back to that one. The horse that the victor rode or the chariot that he was in, was pulled by white horses. And this was a token in honor of his victory. The triumph was a parade, a military parade, with all the plunder of war and the captured enemy in procession behind the cheering crowd, in front of the cheering crowd as the victor was in the front, receiving the honors on that white horse or in the chariot pulled by white horses. I saw a white horse, and him that sat upon him had a bow. If you went to war 2,000 years ago, there was a bunch of different weapons you had at your disposal. And if they were on the field of battle where it's not besieging a city, but you've got two armies that are about to clash, they had a number of different things that they did. And the Romans had their legions, and they would have these big long shields that could actually hook together, and they would form a wall or could actually hold them up over their heads, and it was called a testudo, which is the Greek word for tortoise. And they would form this impenetrable wall, and they would charge for the enemy, and they had these short broad swords that were used for thrusting. Now, that was the legionnaire. If you were on horseback, you had a couple of different weapons. We're going to look at one of them in just a little bit. But one of them, they had special auxiliary, did I say that right, forces that used bows. Now, sometimes they're on foot, sometimes they're on horseback. The benefit of a bow, and it's a very old weapon, is that I don't have to be real close to my enemy in order to get him. As a matter of fact, sometimes there was, when Ahab was killed, wicked King Ahab was killed at the end of the book of 1 Kings, a Syrian soldier drew and shot at random and killed him. At random. Hit him in the joints of his armor. And you would have volleys of arrows just launched at like a 45 degree angle, and they would go up and then they would descend. And some of them are going to hit the target. And I don't have to, if I'm well protected, if I'm well armed in front of me and above me in the testudo type thing or something like that, I'm impenetrable. But I've got this, it's like having a gun these days. This is the best thing they had in the old days. And so you had the bow, and that's a picture of a Roman bow. So this one has he's on the white horse, he is the victor. And he has the bow. And it says, and a crown was given unto him. Now we talked about there's two different types of crowns in Greek. They're both translated crown in English. One is the word we get our English word diadem from, and that would be like a king's crown. But the other one is a victor's crown, something you would earn like in the Greek games and so on. That's what this is. And when a general was given a triumph, he wore a victor's crown. Not a king's crown unless he was the king himself. He wore a victor's crown. This is something he had earned, not something he had inherited, but rather something he had earned. And it says he went forth conquering and to conquer. He has the bow. The indication is that is twofold. Some have tried to read back into things that he's conquering by peace, that it's all diplomacy. But there has been some of that. If you were to, if you have an opportunity sometime when you're sitting at a computer, look up a world map of the British Empire at its peak. And it was huge. The old adage was the sun never sets on the British Empire. And here's an interesting thing. Most of it was not conquered. They would come into a place and they would get chummy with the locals. Third, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or someplace in Asia. And they would work up a trade agreement perhaps with these folks. You guys have something we want. We'll be happy to give you textiles or foodstuffs that you don't have or weapons or jewelry or glass or anything that you're interested in. We'll make an agreement with you. But in order to do this, we want you to sign on the dotted line. Okay, sounds good to us. Well, that would bring their territory under the auspices of the British Empire. Now, understand that most of the time, it didn't make any difference. It's fascinating. All the trouble that Gandhi went through and all the people that died and all the demonstrations and all this stuff that went on to gain Indian independence. And a number of years after Indian independence, they decided they were going to take a survey in the length and breadth of India. This is after their independence, after they're being ruled, self-rule. And they wanted to find out if things were better under self-rule than they were under British rule. And as they began the survey and began to get out into the country and so on, after a few months they gave up. Because there was huge swaths of the country that had no idea that they were independent or ever had been under British rule. They were clueless. And so some have said that this is a gaining of an empire by diplomacy, but I don't think so. He's got a bow in his hand. And he's doing this by conquering. He went out, and what does it say? He went forth conquering and to conquer. And warfare is the natural habitat of humanity. It is what we do. If you look at charts of world population, and of course in the last two centuries it skyrocketed. But why was it that for thousands of years, it wasn't quite flat line, but we saw this very slow incremental growth of humanity? And why was it? We could say, well, it was due to disease. It was due to the fact that life expectancy may have been 37. But understand that women were having 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 children. It had to do with the fact that not just warfare, but genocide was standard operating procedure. And countries weren't big because of limited communication, limited transportation. If your little country, let's say Pierce County, okay, or the Puyallup Indians, and for whatever reason, the salmon didn't run up the river for 2 years running, and we're in a hard way. But we have heard that the Green River runs have just been phenomenal. And so we're going to spend several months training and several months building weapons and everything else, and then when they're not, and we're going to send spies up, and we're going to look things over, and when they're not suspecting it, we're going to go up, and we're going to wipe out everybody that lives along the Green River and take over that territory, because we'll be able to survive there. Folks, that is how people operated for thousands of years. Thousands of years. And by the way, they did it here in North America as well as over on the other side. He went forth conquering to conquer. Now remember, the rapture has happened. We will be dealing with a number of other huge phenomena. But consider several things that are going to happen when the rapture takes place. Not only are you going to have a serious disruption that's going to last for a number of months, frankly, as they put the pieces together, as they come up with explanations, and people are going to be rattled, and how is this going to be taken care of, and what happened to so-and-so, and it's going to affect some countries far more than others. There are Christians everywhere, but there's a lot of places where Christians have no positions of authority, no positions of responsibility. They are, by culture and government and so on, rendered to be the lowest of the low in the land. And then there's other places where they are mingled with everybody else. And if they were to all disappear in the twinkling of an eye, it's going to have a huge impact. It's going to have a huge impact in sub-Saharan Africa. It's going to have a huge impact in a lot of Latin America. And frankly, it'll probably have a huge impact in North America. Some places in Europe. Some places in Asia. There's going to be other places that they would say, hi, I understand that something has happened in other places around the world and we didn't notice it here. And so the dynamic of which countries are the most influential, there's going to be a shakeup in the power structure around the world. And there are going to be folks that are going to take advantage of that shakeup. And so we have and I don't necessarily, a lot of folks say, who is the guy on the white horse? Well, the indication is that there's a rider on all four of these horses. And I think we're dealing with phenomena rather than necessarily individuals. The Antichrist does not really come on the scene and reveal himself for who he is until the halfway point of the tribulation. This is the beginning. And so we have him going out, conquering, and to conquer. Warfare going on. It's fascinating when you have shakeups. We have had this idea, and sometimes it's a personality. If you have the right set of circumstances where you have countries that are weak or unwilling, you have the rise of people that will build empires. Deal with the 20th century, we could deal with Hitler if you want to, that the British and the French had the upper hand until 1936 or 7. They could have stopped him, and they could, because on paper, they were committed to do so. When the war actually started in 1939, somebody asked Winston Churchill, what should we call this? I mean, the World War I was at the time called the Great War. What should we call this? And he said, the Unnecessary War. Because we could have stopped it. We could have very easily prevented it. But people were unwilling to. And throughout history, there have always been people with great ambition, great ability, and great ambition that would seize the opportunity. And they would take it, and they would run with it, and they would go as far as they could. We don't hear about Napoleon anymore, but Napoleon did absolutely, I mean, he had an empire as big as Hitler's. And he had it for just a little bit longer, but not much. And millions and millions and millions and millions of people died. And the political map of Europe was turned upside down because of Napoleon. Just as it was by Hitler. And we could go back centuries before then and see how it was done before then. Did you know that Lithuania used to be a major power? Lithuania. Did you know there was a time when Sweden was a huge power? Sweden! I didn't know that. Yes, they both had empires and conquered other nations. The Lithuanians had the Russians and the Germans under their thumb for a while. Seize the opportunity. Seize the weakness of others. Following the rapture and the things that are going to be going on there, it's going to shake up things. And people are going to seize the opportunity. We have, at the beginning of this, looking at other places, looking in Daniel, looking in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25, what starts the tribulation officially is not the rapture. What starts the tribulation officially is where Antichrist, who has, by the way, not been revealed at this point, there's no worries about who he is at the beginning. He isn't revealed until halfway through his reign of 7 years. He makes a 7-year agreement with Israel. A peace accord. Now, why is it that a major European ruler, because that's where he is, scripturally speaking, prophetically, the kingdom of the Antichrist is a continuation of the Roman Empire, as far as the prophets were concerned. And so we assume it's a European base. Why would Israel and Europe form an alliance? Do you know that right now there is so much hatred for Israel because of a number of factors that they are boycotting products in different parts of Europe that have made an Israel stamped on them. They have such a loathing for Israel. Now, here's the question. Why does modern Europe have a loathing for Israel? Wasn't so. There's still people alive that remember the Holocaust. Lots of them. I've met guys that had the tattoos from the camps when I was a kid. Why are we experiencing this surge in anti-Semitism, especially in Europe?
Muslims.
They are gaining power, they are gaining influence, and the rest of the folks are afraid of them. The colonialism of previous European generations that took over the Middle East and took over North Africa and so on, created an apparatus to allow the Muslims that they had formerly been subject to them to allow free immigration into France and Belgium and the Netherlands and Germany and Britain. And part of it also has to do with cheap labor. Hey, it's just the other side of the Mediterranean. Bring them on in. Bring them on in. Bring them on in. But they don't assimilate. They maintain their religion. They maintain their culture. They live in their own neighborhoods by their own choice. And when things don't go their way, they create quite an uproar. And the demand, because Islam means submission. Islam is a religion of peace. Now, this doesn't mean, can't we all just get along? This means, oh, you will submit to us? That's very good. Now we will have peace. That's what they mean. And always have. This is not a new tactic. This is the old, old tactic. So let's ask the question again, why would Israel form an alliance with Europe, principally Western Europe? It's because they have a common enemy. If you have the rapture happen and you have a shakeup in Europe, there's a large component of those who will be left behind that are going to seize the opportunity. And as I've mentioned before, I personally believe that the war that is described in Ezekiel 38 and 39 takes place right at the outset of the tribulation. I think this is the Islamic world seizing the moment and trying to take over. You say, why do you think that? Well, there's several reasons. One is that after the victory in Ezekiel 38 and 39, they burn the weapons of war for 7 years, so there has to be a 7-year window where they can do that. Number two, in 1967, when we had the Six-Day War, and the West Bank was taken by the Israelis, and they had the old city, and there's pictures, and they didn't allow freedom of access to Temple Square and so on to the Jews when it was under Jordanian control. And the Jews came into the Temple Square, and they were just in awe that we have finally, after 2,000 years, gained control again of our holy site. And there was a move by some to rebuild the temple, and Moshe Dayan, the commander of the Israeli forces, said, no, you can't do it. You can't do it. And they actually gave control of the Temple Mount back over to King Hussein of Jordan. Just the mount. Just basically that huge plaza. And the reason was, we have barely by the skin of our teeth defeated the Egyptians and the Syrians and the Jordanians. And if we were to begin construction on the temple, which would require the demolition of the Dome of the Rock, that gold dome, if we were to do that, we would not have to deal with simply Egypt and Syria and Jordan, but the entire Muslim world. And we can't do it. And so they left off. And the hopes of rebuilding the temple are still there, but they have been postponed and postponed and postponed and postponed. And yet we know that halfway through the tribulation, where Antichrist reveals himself, is when we have the abomination of desolations, when he desecrates the temple at the halfway point. Which means that halfway into the tribulation, there must be an operating temple in place in Jerusalem. And you can't build it now, and you can't build it unless you're in Ezekiel 38 and 39. By the way, virtually all the nations that are mentioned there are Islamic nations. By the way, two generations from now, Russia will have an Islamic majority in two generations. And much of Western Europe, it'll be 2 to 4 generations. They'll have an Islamic majority because they have a lot more kids than the folks who have been there for a long time. So if Israel is going to rebuild their temple, there must be the neutralization of Islam. And I think that there will be a number of ventures at the onset of the tribulation. I think that we're not necessarily dealing with a single individual here, but we're going to have a number of attempts to build empires. And again, there have been a lot of attempts. Do you know that Paraguay in South America tried to build an empire at one point? Paraguay. A lot of folks have tried. A lot of folks have tried with varying degrees of success. And some of them with a lot of success. And I could, if give me a little bit of time, I could mention names that you've never heard of that have had huge empires that lasted their lifetime. Because it's usually one guy that can pull it off. And then after he's off the scene, no one has the initiative or the brains to figure out how to do it. Because it's not an easy task. I saw a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Verse 3. And when he opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red. And power was given unto him. This is the idea of him and the rider. Was given unto him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. And that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. We, believe it or not, live in a time of great peace. When this was written, probably in the mid to late 90s of the first century, toward the very tail end of the first century, you had the Roman Empire that ruled the entire Mediterranean basin and a lot of avenues, England, France, even parts of Germany, Romania, all those were part of the Roman Empire. It was actually a time where they went all the way east to Iraq and controlled all that. Egypt to England and Morocco to Armenia and Romania. Everything was Roman Empire. And you had a period of time, lasted about 200 years, called the Pax Romana, the Roman Peace. For thousands of years, mentioned that invasion and genocide was standard operating procedure for humanity. And yet for 200 years, within the borders of the Roman Empire, you had peace. Now that's peace compared to what they had before. We would look at the brutality and everything else that existed in that day. I mean, and we'd just be horrified. But it was relative peace. You could travel freely. I mean, the Apostle Paul, you read about his journeys. He gets on the road, off he goes. You could do that. You didn't have a lot of banditry on the roadsides because the Romans had cleared that. You didn't have piracy on the high seas in the Mediterranean because the Romans had cleared that. You had peace as far as being able to travel, be able to do, to some extent, for the most part, what you wanted to do. It was a very unusual time in world history, the Pax Romana. We live tenuously at present in a world that operates like that for the most part. Now, there are a few places I wouldn't necessarily recommend that you go. And there's also a number of places I wouldn't necessarily recommend you go in the United States at certain times of the day. And sometimes it varies what year it is. You know, 10 years ago it was fine, right now it's not. Or 10 years ago it wasn't, and now it is. Tacoma Hilltop is not the same neighborhood it was when I moved here 30 years ago. 25 years ago or so, I took my wife to New York City. She'd never been there. I'd been there a number of times. She had never been there. And as before kids, and so we stayed in Hackensack, New Jersey. And then when we got up, we got ready, we walked right out to the curb and got on a bus right in front of the hotel. And that bus, after about a 15-20 minute drive, dropped us off at the terminal station in the center part of Manhattan. And I grabbed Aaron's hand and I said, come with me. And we went down three flights of stairs And we went through a turnstile, and this is back in the days when they still used the tokens. They use a little paper card now for getting on the subway. And we dropped our tokens in there, and we ran over and got on the A train. And I said, come on. And we got in there, and we sat down, and we're on the subway. And off we go. And Aaron's eyes, if they're open any wider, would have fallen out of her head. She was absolutely terrified. Now, this is the girl who she and her buddy Diane, when they were teenagers, would drive the 3 hours down to L.A. and walk around to L.A. and go shopping and not think anything of it. But she was figuring, we're going to New York City and there's murder and mayhem everywhere. We're going to see dead bodies lying on the sidewalks. It's just going to be terrifying. And I said, number one, stop looking like a tourist. And then when I sat next to her and I whispered to her, I said, you will see more freaks and weirdos in Seattle in 30 minutes than you will see in Manhattan today. And by the way, more people live in New York City than live in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho combined. Needy place. The number of fundamental churches that are ministering inside the city limits of New York is about the same number that we have here in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Maybe. We live in a time of relative peace. We can travel. Don't have to worry about things. We walked along Central Park. We sat on the wall. There's a wall around Central Park. We sat on the wall and ate a hot dog. Took her to the different museums. Took her to Grand Central. Took her to Grant's tomb. Took her to the Statue of Liberty. Went saw what there was to see in New York. And then we got back on the bus and walked into our hotel room in Hackensack, and she was just dumbfounded that we were still alive and that nothing amazing had really happened to us other than we'd seen some neat stuff. We live in the Pax Americana. But such a phenomena is unusual in American, in world history. They had it when Revelation was written, but that was an unusual window in world history. Peace will be taken away. And so we have the red horse. And he that had it had a sword. Now I mentioned the legionnaires and the auxiliaries that had the bows. A cavalry guy had one of two types of weapons. Sometimes they had a lance. And I don't mean, you know, the guy in the armor and the big thing where they just knock each other off of horses. I'm talking about a spear that was 12 to 16 feet long so that he could get some guy that was some distance away from him. And so as he's riding along, he's stabbing guys and wielding it around and swinging it around and stabbing guys and doing it that way. Now, you can lose your lance that way. You know, you get a guy good and it doesn't come free, you know. Maybe ate glue for lunch or something. Another thing they had was, and we talk about a sword, imagine a sword, a scimitar type thing with a long curved blade. The blade is sharp on the inside of the curve, almost like an open sickle. But it's got a 12-foot handle on it. And he can go through there, and it's a sword, but it's a spear at the same time, but you don't throw it, you hang on to it. And that was the weapon of the cavalry. Gruesome and nasty. The man's on a white horse, he has one of that type of sword. And he takes peace from the earth. Constant warfare. And it says that men should kill one another. I mentioned that, let's say we place ourselves 300 years ago. We have a couple of failed salmon runs on the Puyallup, but the green is running great. And so they go up there, they wipe out the tribe that's living along there. They take their place. But if I'm going to take their place, I have to wipe them out. If I just go up there and defeat them, then I've got all these other folks that might eventually rise up and kill me. So I got to wipe them out so I don't have to worry about that. Besides that, if they stick around, I got to feed them. I mean, the best scenario is really to enslave them, but even then, they might rise up against me. So I wipe them out. Standard operating procedure. Genocide is how people have operated. We think of genocide in the 20th century. We think of Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis there in Rwanda. Understand that a generation before the tables were turned, and that's why they had the Rwanda genocide that we know about. Because the other tribe killed off the other guys to begin with. We might think about the Armenian genocide that happened a little over 100 years ago, where the Turks, who have yet to this day to admit that it happened, even though there's all sorts of evidence, where they killed at least 2 million people. We are, of course, familiar with the Holocaust. We are familiar with how did Stalin industrialize Russia in the 20s and 30s, mostly the 30s. How did he industrialize? Well, he had to have capital. What did he do? He took all the wheat that was grown in the Ukraine and sold it to the West and then bought equipment and built factories. Well, what did he feed his people? He didn't. And they died of starvation. Millions of Ukrainians. This is, by the way, one of the reasons why the Ukrainians are not necessarily real keen on the Russians. They have a bunch of reasons why, but that's one of them. Stalin killed probably as many people as Hitler did. And if you want to look at the Cultural Revolution in China, Mao killed more than twice as many as Hitler even dreamed of killing. Genocide in the 20th century. Small scale. Thousands of people here and there, happens all the time. If it has political implications or can get some traction to help somebody's career here, we hear about it. Otherwise, we don't. People die on the field of battle. And in ancient times, they didn't take prisoners unless somebody could potentially be used as a slave. They killed them all. This is a picture taken in 1943. This is a very ironic picture. This is in the Katyn Forest in Poland. There's a couple of people here. I think these two guys down here might be familiar with this. This is a very ironic thing, and this did not get a lot of press until probably about 20, 25 years ago. Because when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939 and officially started World War II, he had, prior to that invasion, made an agreement with Stalin. They were going to divide Poland. They had a line already divided. And when Hitler invaded from the west, the Russians, the Soviets invaded from the east. And they wiped out the Polish army. And they conquered and obliterated Poland and incorporated it into their own countries. Stalin did that. He was buddies with Hitler until Hitler betrayed him and invaded in 1941. But they were buddies. Where did Hitler get all of his raw materials when he was beating the French and the English? It was coming in the east side from the Russians. Stalin was more than happy to do that. Stalin was more than happy to build his own empire. And when the Russians conquered the eastern half of Poland, they took all the intelligentsia and all the leadership, the military officers, the politicians, the folks, the college professors and so on, and they took them out to the Katyn Forest, and they lined them up, and they killed 22,000 men with gunshots to the back of their heads, executed 22,000 men. Not the Nazis. The Soviets did this. And then buried him in a mass grave. It was discovered, ironically, by the Nazis. And Goring himself, who was no great guy, said, they're never going to believe this. They're going to say we did it. Now, they pumped it for all kinds of publicity in country. Because they exhumed this, and this is pictures actually taken by the Germans. They're in the Katyn Forest in Poland. They dug them up 3 years after they were executed in 1940. And the Russians denied it until about 20 years ago, after the supposed fall of communism, and the papers were published, and yes, this is what happened. Yes, this was authorized by Stalin. Genocide is standard operating procedure for humanity. And when you take Christians out of the world, you take the Spirit's influence through this small light and salt community that we are, and you take that out of the world. Do you know that really outside of Christianity and Christian influence, let me say Christian influence, the whole concept of mercy is almost foreign to humanity. There is no mercy outside of Christian influence. Almost none. It was mocked. It was considered cowardly and soft. Because we have to kill. We have to do, if we're going to survive Darwinian philosophy. The Nazis were real big on Darwinian philosophy. If we're going to survive, we have to be the strongest. And we have to wipe out the weak. And so we have the man on the white horse with a bow in his hand, and he went out conquering and to conquer. But when you conquer, what are you going to do with the conquered people? I can enslave them. I can force them to submit and subject. But understand that a subjected people are a dangerous people because they can always rise up. Here's a question for you. What happened to all the young people that demonstrated at Tiananmen Square? Where are they? They're all dead. Now that doesn't get a lot of traction in the West, but it's true. What's going to happen to all these young people that are demonstrating in Hong Kong unless they come up with a different resolution than the communists coming in hard? This is why they're trying to do their best to disguise their identity. Because these days with facial recognition and all this other stuff, it's very difficult to hide. The red horse. Because when people conquer, they kill. We have the seizing of the moment after the rapture. The upsetting of world equilibrium. The peace, relative peace that we experience in the world today will be taken away. And wicked people, and there are plenty of them, will seize the moment and seize the opportunity and seek to build empires and to wipe out anybody that opposes them. This is one of the reasons why during the course of the tribulation, 2/3 of the world population or more will die in 7 years. Because humanity left unrestrained is a murderous people. And so the tribulation begins, but this is just the beginning. The white horse, the red horse. Next time we'll look at the pale horse, or the black horse and the pale horse. Okay, any additional questions or comments on anything we've talked about or looked at tonight?
No, I
personally believe that they are emblematic of four concepts that you are going to have. Empire building, following it, you will have genocide, the killing of multitudes of people. Okay. Not just on the field of battle, but following. The next one, the black horse, is famine, and the last one is death. Because it's when you have warfare, you have these things in sequence. When war starts, the wars begin, you have the mobilization of armies and so on. Following it, you have the death of multitudes. And because things have been upset, because the economies have been disrupted, because the fields have not been plowed and sown, you deal with famine following. Because there's no food. And then following that, you have death, because not only are we dealing with genocide and people being killed in battle, but now we're dealing with starvation. And they all follow in succession. So I don't believe we're dealing with individuals. I think we're dealing with concepts, ideas. Yes. All right. Does he know the Lord?
He says he does know the Lord.
All right. And his name is Floyd.
Carl.
All right.
And I got a witness to his wife.
All right. We'll pray for that opportunity. We'll also pray for his health. Pray for me. Starting tomorrow morning, I preach up at Cascade Vista Baptist Schools Monday through Friday for the opening of school. And the first two services will be evangelistic. You're dealing with a lot of kids that have sat under the gospel for their whole lives. And a number of years ago, had a young girl get saved when I did this probably 4 or 5 years ago, who got saved. Christian home. Her family's part of Galley Baptist Church. And Lord saved her. So pray for Lord to work in hearts this next week. First 2 days, evangelistic. Second 2 days, dealing with restoration. And the last day, Friday, will be commitment and service. So pray for that, if you would. Pray for voice and stamina. Although it's improving. It's pretty good. Pretty good. Anything else? I'll do that. I'm about to pray. All right, let's pray. Father, we do thank you for your grace and for your mercy. Father, thank you that we live in the times that we do. Father, we look at so many things and we can come up with lots of things to complain about and lament about and grieve about. But Father, compared to the supposed good old days, these are pretty good days. And yet, Father, we can see around us the indications of what is coming. And Father, I pray that we would seize the opportunity of freedom to share the gospel. Father, pray for a man named Carl who's in the hospital dealing with some heart issues. Pray for his wife. And I pray for Susan, Father, for her outspokenness, for her prayers. Lord, that she would continue in these things. I pray you give her boldness and opportunity to minister to the neighbors and folks that she runs into. And Father, pray for the preaching of the word this week up in Kent. Lord, that you would touch the hearts of these young people. And so often, I was talking to Leo about it earlier this evening, the people so often who hear it over and over and over again grow callous to it, and they see no need, and they don't recognize that they have it. They think they're good to go. And Father, I pray that you would touch the hearts of these young people, and I pray there'd be a brokenness before you. Transform lives. And Father, may the school year be a time not only of education, but also of discipleship as they deal with new believers. Father, may you bring this about. Thank you for your grace and for your goodness. Father, may we learn the things that we learned, may we take the things that we learned tonight. And Father, use them as a catalyst for evangelism. May this spur us on to seize the moment, we pray for Christ's sake. Amen.